striking a balance between liberty and security. Today, Tuesday, November 19th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. Today, Senator Ron Wyden gives us his take on the NSA surveillance debate.
I've always been sort of a Ben Franklin guy who essentially anybody who gives up their liberty to have security, Ben Franklin said, really doesn't deserve either.
Also, selfie may be word of the year, but unselfie is trending as a way to help survivors in the Philippines.
We've had response from the State Department. John Kerry has posted one. Mia Farrow has retweeted something, and we've just seen, you know, an amazing kind of response to this.
Plus, Japan's Bunny Island.
You can't avoid the bunnies. They're everywhere.
But don't let the cuteness fool you. This place has a dark, dark past.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Add Norway to the list of nations touched by Edward Snowden's NSA leaks. Officials in Oslo are the latest on the defensive because of Snowden's surveillance revelations. Administration officials in Washington know the feeling well, and that's a good thing, says Senator Ron Wyden. The Oregon Democrat has long advocated for greater limits on surveillance. I asked him earlier if he considered Snowden a hero or a traitor. Wyden didn't want to talk about that, but the senator did welcome the changes in Washington since the revelations started.
6 months ago, you wouldn't have seen more than 200 votes on the floor of the House of Representatives for fundamental reform that protects the privacy of law-abiding Americans. You wouldn't have seen Senator Udall and I be able to push the intelligence agencies to take down fact sheets that were on their website that inflated what they were doing in terms of privacy protection. So it's fair to say that now there's going to be a full-fledged debate on these issues, and it's high time.
Okay. Now, as you said, the intelligence community is speaking in a way that's confusing or downright misleading. But by its very nature, shouldn't intelligence speak be kind of confusing? I mean, you know, you don't really want to show your hand and give away secrets, do you?
Of course you don't want to give away secrets and secret operations, but there is a difference between keeping operations secret and keeping the law secret. There is a difference between secret operations and secret law. The law always ought to be public because that's what you need to ensure that the electorate can participate in fundamental decisions about government policy. If somebody sits down at their laptop, for example, and read the Patriot Act, Section 215, you'd see the words, these investigations are going to be relevant to an inquiry about terrorism. That's what the plain reading of that text would be. You wouldn't see anything that would suggest that you would have millions and millions of phone records collected on law-abiding, you know, Americans.
If I may play devil's advocate for a moment, we've been pretty safe, it seems, since 9/11. Couldn't there be an argument made that whatever the NSA and other agencies are doing is working?
The question, first of all, with respect to these practices is, what do you get when you engage in practices that violate people's privacy and personal liberties that you could not get with existing authorities? That's the operative question.
And what are you doing to rein in the NSA's power? And how optimistic are you that you can get something done? Because most of your fellow congressmen and women don't seem to agree with you.
First of all, I'm very encouraged about where we are. We're looking at a debate about surveillance authorities. I've introduced legislation with Senator Udall, Senator Paul, and Senator Blumenthal, for example, to ban the bulk collection of phone records on law-abiding Americans, to prohibit backdoor searches where Americans are swept up when they're is an effort to target a foreigner, and I think we ought to have an independent advocate in the FISA court because this is a one-sided process, and you really ought to hear both sides. So I'm very encouraged about where we are today, And I think reformers are really coming together.
There are lots of people saying that surveillance technology is outpacing our ability to contain or regulate it. Do you think government will ever catch up?
It used to be that there were limits on technology. And as a result of those limits, the American people got a measure of privacy protection. Now the technology is capable, essentially, of doing anything. And that's why it's so important that a better balance be struck in the law between protecting security and liberty. I've always been sort of a Ben Franklin guy who essentially anybody who gives up their liberty to have security, Ben Franklin said, really doesn't deserve either.
Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, thank you, sir, for your time.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to doing it again sometime.
America's intelligence services aren't seen too kindly around the world right now, pretty much as you'd expect when it's revealed that you're monitoring the calls of close allies. But as you know, there are others in the surveillance doghouse as well. Here's the world's Alex Galifant.
Australia is the latest country to be embarrassed by documents leaked by Edward Snowden. These documents indicate that in 2009, Australian snoops targeted the cell phone of Indonesia's president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. But that wasn't the first allegation, says Sam Rogoveen. He's with the Lowy Institute for International Policy in Sydney.
A couple of weeks ago, the Sydney Morning Herald, one of Australia's biggest newspapers, ran a story saying that Australia was using its embassy in Jakarta to spy on Indonesia. And now, just a few days ago, emerged much more specific allegations via Snowden.
Those were published by The Guardian and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And they claimed that Australia had targeted the cell phones of not only the Indonesian president, but his wife and other senior officials and politicians. In response, Indonesia has recalled its ambassador from Australia. Here's Indonesia's foreign minister, Marty Natalegawa.
It is nothing less than an unfriendly act, which is having already a very serious impact on our bilateral relations.
It's certainly very embarrassing for Australia, just as similar revelations about American spying have made for uncomfortable moments in the White House.
What is the justification for trying to spy on the phone calls of the president or his wife?
Christine Milne leads Australia's Green Party.
Are we saying that we think our closest neighbour's president is a security risk to Australia? Is that what we're saying?
In other words, this isn't the way you treat your friends. But in general, Australia's leading politicians have defended the country's intelligence operations without admitting the specific allegations contained in the leaked documents. Tony Abbott is Australia's new Prime Minister.
There have been calls for Australia to detail our intelligence operations and to apologise for them. Madam Speaker, the first duty of every government is to protect the country and to advance its national interests. That's why every government gathers information and why every government knows that every other government gathers information.
What Prime Minister Abbott seems to be saying is this: we all spy on each other and we all know it. It's just a bit weird to be talking about it in the open, so please can we just stop? Indonesia won't stop talking about it, of course, not yet. They've been publicly wronged, and that gives them a morsel of leverage over Australia.
I think we're in the doghouse, and I think we're going to be in the doghouse for a while.
Again, that's analyst Sam Rogoveen in Sydney. He points out that Indonesia's leaders are likely to make Australia pay for this episode. He expects them to exert pressure on one issue in particular: asylum seekers who arrive on Australian shores by boat.
They come via Indonesia, so we need Indonesia's cooperation to stop the flow of asylum seekers. That's been a huge priority for this new government in the first 6 weeks of its term. I don't think we should expect more than the bare minimum of cooperation on that from Indonesia.
Certainly, Australia's public reaction to this diplomatic mess hasn't softened Indonesia's public response. Michael Brissenden is a journalist for the ABC.
The president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, has been tweeting today that he's less than impressed with the way this is rolled out and certainly with the way the prime minister has responded to it. He wants a personal explanation.
You know, there's something knife-twisting about calling for an explanation via Twitter. See how open and transparent we are, it seems to say, in contrast to your grubby secret spy games. But perhaps that's just as much a smokescreen as the notion that countries don't spy on their friends. In most cases, it seems, they do, and they will. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant.
Just a few years ago, horrific drug violence was out of control in the Mexican border city of Juarez, just south of El Paso, Texas. But the murder rate has been dropping in Juarez recently, and residents there seem to be reclaiming their city from traffickers and other criminals. But a new massacre has once again shaken the community. Alfredo Corchado is reporting on the story for the Dallas Morning News. Alfredo, why are people in Juarez particularly shaken by this new crime?
Well, this is a new low, Aaron. We're talking about children. Eight people were found massacred on Sunday, three of them children, ages four, and then a little boy at age of six. So it's reopened a lot of old wounds and old memories, and it's been a tough weekend for Juarez. Ironically, a week ago, they were celebrating the return of Juarez. It was a big opera that attracted people from both sides of the border, and people were signaling that as the official return, the new Juarez, if you will.
Now, as you said, the last major killing was 10 people at a party, and as horrific as that is, it is somewhat familiar. It fits in with the pattern of drug violence. What does it all say about Juarez and its efforts to become a more peaceful place?
I think what it says more than anything is that if you look at Juarez as a patient, as a clinical patient, the patient is still in remission. It's not necessarily in recovery. You see this, a lot of the same symptoms. It's an area infested by many drug members, gang members. Just a week ago, neighbors were talking about a mother who was walking by, a mother of seven, who was hit by a stray bullet and killed. So, you know, you have seven kids now without a mother. But in talking to neighbors, many of them were wearing masks. They didn't want to be identified. I mean, it's that kind of a fear. As much as I think as the new administration of Enrique Peña Nieto wants to talk about a new narrative in Mexico, and as much as Juarez wants to kind of look ahead, the ills of the past are still very much present.
Yes, some have criticized Mexico's president for downplaying the violence in order to make Mexico's image more positive. Juarez seems like a perfect example of that.
Exactly. The administration will tell you that the violent crimes are down by 20%. And maybe that's true. I mean, Ciudad Juarez is much, much more peaceful than it has been in the past. But you talk to restaurant owners, you talk to just the average person, and they complain of extortions, they complain of kidnappings. And obviously these two massacres that tell you that the El Juarez is still very much alive.
Alfredo, you live in Mexico City, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, but you travel to Juarez, I imagine, with some frequency. What is the feeling you get from the place as far as daily life goes? Is there such thing anymore in Juarez as daily life?
Well, on the good side, you do see people trying to kind of bring back a sense of normalcy. You see businesses that are going up. More than 30,000 people fled Juarez for El Paso, and some of them are going back. They're trying to open up restaurants, but there's still that sense of fear. There's still that sense of this isn't over yet.
What is your sense of the place? Is it safer now than it was 3 years ago?
Definitely. I mean, as a correspondent, I mean, you feel a lot safer. You talk to cab drivers, and they say, look, things are not the same as they were before. I mean, there was always this fear of you take a certain road, you might run into a shooting or something. You know, that's not there anymore. But the city doesn't have a police chief. The police chief left 2 months ago. They haven't found one. And there is that concern that while the old police chief faced a lot of criticism, a lot of allegations of human rights abuse, I think he did a lot in trying to bring some sense of stability back in the city. So there is that worry, you know, who will take over? There's a new mayor who just took office 2 months ago. So there's a lot of questions that remain unanswered in Ciudad Juarez.
Alfredo Corchado is Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. He spoke with us about the situation these days in Ciudad Juarez, just south of El Paso, Texas. Alfredo, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron. My pleasure.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com and by reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. What do you do if you have a heart condition and you need a pacemaker, but you only have a dollar a day to live on? A British charity thinks it has an answer. Send second-hand pacemakers removed from people who have died to be reused in developing countries. The organization Pace for Life says thousands of the life-saving devices are typically thrown away or buried with patients each year. Balasandram Lavan is the founder of Pace for Life.
We're taking consent forms. We're getting patients or family members to donate these simple little devices. Take them, test them. If they're fit for human reuse with 70% battery life or more, we are getting them re-sterilized and then looking to kind of get them implanted in the developing world.
The charity is taking its lead from the University of Michigan, which has been researching the reuse of pacemakers for the past 4 years. Thomas Crawford is a cardiologist and assistant professor of medicine at the university.
The two main risks are the risk of infection of the device and the risk of mechanical malfunction. There's always a risk of infection anytime you implant a pacemaker, but specifically when you re-implant the pacemaker that's previously been implanted in a human body, there's a possibility for blood and body fluids to seep into the header of the device. So it's very important to make sure that there's a properly conducted cleaning and sterilization. And the second risk is the malfunction because the device would be taken out of the deceased and reprocessed. There could be potential damage to the microprocessors or the really intricate inside of the pacemaker.
How do you donate one of these? Is this just like any other real organ where a patient signs a release before he or she dies?
So we have developed relationships with many funeral homes and crematories across the country, and we have a consent that the family members or the patients before they die would sign, and they instruct their morticians on donating the pacemaker. Then the funeral homes and crematories request postage paid envelope from us, and we send them the envelope, and we basically receive it for reevaluation of the battery life and reprocessing. The pacemakers themselves are quite small. And so if you put it in a biohazard bag, which is what we provide, in an envelope, it gets to us safely.
Now, your program has been happening informally with doctors taking used pacemakers to developing countries, right?
We are currently not sending any devices. Several years ago when we first started this project, we sent a limited number of pacemakers to the Philippines.
So that was part of a study then?
It was part of a study. However, as we explored the legal and regulatory issues involved, we decided that we really needed an approval from the U.S. FDA to be able to send reprocessed pacemakers.
And if the FDA signs off on this, the program will be in use both in America and overseas, or just one or the other?
No, I mean, we never conceive of implanting these pacemakers in the United States. The FDA approves pacemakers as single-use devices. And so in the United States, it is not legal to reimplant these pacemakers. We don't believe that these pacemakers are just as good as brand new ones. What we acknowledge is that there are many people in the world who die because they don't have access to this therapy because it's too expensive. So if the choice is between having a reused, reprocessed pacemaker versus not having a pacemaker at all, the choice for most individuals is to avail themselves of the possibility of getting a free pacemaker.
It sounds like it's lesser than, but better than nothing.
Absolutely.
So we've said that these devices are better than nothing. Do you have any handle on how many people are dying, let's say, because they don't have access to this technology?
There are no reliable estimates. There's some suspicion that there may be as many as 1 million people that die in the world each year because slow heart rates, but that's just an estimate.
Thomas Crawford is a cardiologist and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Michigan. Dr. Crawford, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time now for a sideways glance. That's our regular series where we find a story that makes us do a double take. Today, the world's Nina Porzuki takes us to an island just off the coast of Japan.
Looking for a honeymoon spot? What about the tiny island of Okinojima?
It's absolutely beautiful.
That's Professor Ellis Krauss. He directs the University of California Exchange Program in Japan. And he takes his students to visit this pretty little island, also known as Rabbit or Bunny Island.
You can't avoid the bunnies. They're everywhere.
And he means everywhere. Hundreds of them live on the island, which is less than half a square mile large. The island, part of a national park, is also hopping with tourists. And why not? There's a golf course, playgrounds, tennis courts, hiking trails, and yes, a honeymoon hotel. Which is strange, says Kraus, because this warm and fuzzy little island actually has a pretty chilling past.
I mean, this would be a little bit like creating a honeymoon hotel in Los Alamos or Alamogordo, New Mexico, where the atom bomb was developed.
For nearly 20 years, from 1929 until the end of World War II, Bunny Island was the center of chemical weapons research and production in Japan.
It was a super secret island. In fact, trains passing on the mainland had to lower their shades so that passengers couldn't even see the island during the war. And everybody on the island who worked in the chemical weapons productions were sworn to secrecy.
Over 6,000 tons of poison gas were produced on the island. And the test subjects for the chemicals, according to Kraus, yes, I'm sorry to say, were the bunnies. But the bunnies currently living on the island are not descendants of the bunnies tested. The original bunnies were euthanized in 1945 when the Americans occupied Japan and took over Okinojima Island. The Americans also sunk half of the amassed weapons into the sea. As for the other half of the weapons manufactured on the island,
about 3,000 tons were shipped to China and actually used in China in Japan's invasion of China after 1937. I believe about 80,000 Chinese were killed by these chemical weapons. And in the little museum on the island, there are actually pictures of Japanese soldiers with gas masks in China using the chemical weapons.
Today, as you hike around the tiny island, it's hard not to bump into the remnants of its past. A dilapidated lab building, crumbled bunkers used to store weapons, and then, of course, the hordes upon hordes of bunnies.
Where's the ordinary rabbit? That's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on. That rabbit's got a vicious streak a mile wide. It's a killer.
Okay, there are no killer rabbits. But from the endless online videos of tourists feeding them, the rabbits do look unnaturally large and aggressive.
This one is a greedy one. You are greedy.
One final note on Bunny Island. It's located just an hour and a half from another horrific World War II landmark, Hiroshima.
It's just the existence of this island with its past so close to Hiroshima really represents the two sides of the Pacific War. You know, what we did to the Japanese at Hiroshima and the type of militaristic behavior that Japan did, which is represented by Bunny Island, Okinojima, in which they produced this horrible, horrible weapon as well and used it on other people.
For the world, I'm Nina Porzuki.
If you want to see what those cute rabbits on Bunny Island look like, we've got videos. They're actually a bit disturbing. At PRI.org. You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Coming up, is the saga of Toronto Mayor Rob Ford opera worthy? You bet.
One staff member reported getting drunken phone calls from Ford in the middle of the night from his father's gravesite. That would be probably the central aria in the third act of one of Verdi's operas.
Plus, the sounds of Leonardo's Viola Organista.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The news from the war in Syria is bleak. The conflict is at a stalemate, which means no end in sight for those caught behind the grim headlines. But it's not often we get to hear what that means, exactly. Raith Abdulahad has spent considerable time in Syria listening to people's stories there. Abdulahad is a journalist for The Guardian, based in Istanbul. In his latest piece, he writes about three Syrians who work with a moderate opposition battalion, a businessman, a smuggler, and an army defector. The businessman was once a wealthy investor in Homs, but has lost much of his fortune in the war. Abdulahad says at one point the businessman surprised him by saying it would be better for Syria if the war continued for at least 2 more years.
That was the strangest thing I've heard in my life. I mean, here is a man who have invested everything, you know, money, family, friends, power, everything in trying to fight the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Yet the realpolitik of the civil war kind of forces him to stop and calculate. If Bashar falls now, the Islamists are very strong. He will be defeated by the Islamists. So he stops and questions all of this and says, no, I don't want Bashar to fall now. I want 2 years to, quote unquote, to organize the internal Syrian house before we continue in our war against Bashar. And it's a very strange thing because I accompanied him into Syria and I accompanied him into this battle where he was fighting the regime of Bashar. But all the time, the main threat, the main calculation came not from Bashar, but from the Islamists and the jihadis.
Now, the next character you introduce us to is the arms smuggler. It would seem to me that this would be good times for an arms smuggler.
So the smuggler, he lost his father. I mean, during the summer, I would sit with him while he Skyped with his family. He was in Turkey, his family was in Syria. And his father was besieged in the village. And every day I would listen to him and him pleading with his mother, please, mother, take my father and bring him out. And now, when I ask him this time, so what happened to your father? He just smiled and said he died. He was injured and they couldn't get him out and he died. So here is another person who again invested and again lost. And now the smuggler, every day he goes on Google Earth on his Samsung S3 and starts kind of pinching and moving and trying to find his house and finding kind of the shed where they kept their sheep and cows.
Let's mention the third character. He's an army defector. Tell us about his background.
He is the kind of the most romantic of the three, and he, unlike many of the army officers in the Middle East, this guy is very educated. He loves reading. He draws lessons from history. He's very brave. He's from a Bedouin family, so he has this aura, this character. Became very famous because he managed to bring some tanks from the regime.
In your article, you talk about being in the company of these men, talking with them, learning about their lives and perspectives as the battles are going on. And you talk about it, the fight like street children throwing stones in an alleyway. Is this all in a way like a game that everyone is required to play?
In a way, yes. It is sometimes becoming like a game. You know, even them, they question, what are we fighting for at this moment? So after a few days of fighting, after they captured this military outpost, and after this initial sense of military euphoria kind of passes away, then they start questioning, what did we achieve by taking this outpost? We've reached a point, I think, in Syria where the rebels have lost momentum. I mean, this battalion went and attacked this army outpost. Things are happening on the left and on the right without any coordination. To go attack this army outpost, we had to drive within this tiny little corridor within government troops. Easily, they could have been cut from behind and they've been surrounded because there is no coordination between the rebel groups. There is no a central plan to go and attack one unit after one unit. It's all done within chaotically. I mean, one of the most important things I've learned from this article, the role of the funders, you know, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, and other individuals who all come to Syria and want to play the role of a general. You know, I go to Syria now with $150,000. I can just manipulate one of these battalions, one of these very good, honest men, and I can make them fight my own war for whatever reason until I run out of $150,000 and I go out. And it's a very absurd. And they need it. They need the money. They're so desperate for the money. So they're willing to take the money from everyone else. But they reach a point where they start questioning it now. They question, what's the purpose of all this fighting?
And they all seem fairly pessimistic about the outcome.
The fight is more, how do we say, a fight for life at this moment. And they know that it's only a matter of time where a confrontation will start between them and the jihadis. So that is where now you see them frantically trying to build alliances, trying to get money, trying to get ammunition. In a way, I like those three guys because, unlike many others, they kind of calculate to the future. They stop being romantic rebels and they are very pragmatist and trying to calculate how can we survive tomorrow.
Thank you for speaking with us. It's an incredible story.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ghayath Abdul Ahad is correspondent for The Guardian. He travels frequently into Syria. We have a link to his latest story at PRI.org. Syrians were inspired to take up arms against their government by the revolutions in other Arab countries, including Libya. But 2 years after the toppling of dictator Muammar Gaddafi, Libya is still picking up the pieces. Militia groups are refusing to disarm and guns are easy to find. There are frequent kidnappings. And to make matters worse, there isn't a stable government yet. The BBC's Rana Jawad is in Tripoli. She told me earlier about some of the latest violence in Libya.
What we saw on Friday was the protesters in Tripoli take to the streets and head towards the base of one of the militias, one of the many militias that are based in the capital. They're originally from the western city of Misrata. They went there trying to evict them from their headquarters, and they were immediately, according to witnesses, met with live gunfire, including anti-aircraft guns. 47 people were killed on that day, and more than 480 people were injured.
And Rana, this is unfortunately fairly indicative of the lawlessness now in Libya, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, the government hasn't really made any secret of it. They are well aware that they're not in control. They have said it in so many different ways, and they say they are trying to work with the capacity they have on hand. They always insist that they're still rebuilding their security forces, and this is the reality, basically, that they don't feel like they can face all the various armed groups that currently exist. What we have seen in the last couple of days, specifically since yesterday, really, is the deployment of the army onto the streets of Tripoli. That's a first here. You know, some of the reactions included people really being astonished, saying, oh, we have an army. So that's how much, you know, the security presence here has been missed, if you will.
And it isn't only regular folk in Libya who are frustrated. Salah al-Mahani, the justice minister, said to your colleague, Jeremy Bowen, that he wasn't very impressed with where things stand either.
I think we failed the Libyan people on realizing how difficult it would be to deal with the fallout from the revolution, revenge taking place, allowing for security to deteriorate. We need to do more.
Rana Jawad, what exactly can the government do now?
Well, the most they can do is, I suppose, keep up their own presence and their own dialogue with the public. There are different players in the field. The government has repeatedly said they need as much help as they can get from the public. And by the public, they also mean the sort of more traditional channels of, you know, brokering or leading negotiations or, you know, trying to calm things down. Because at the moment, emotions are very high in the capital. I mean, I just came back from a small protest earlier. There have been protests ongoing for the last 3 days, and not very big, but there are people who are remaining in one of the main squares where they've been demonstrating, and they say they're not leaving. Even at the end of this 3-day general strike, and they're hoping they can extend it, but they're not leaving until all the militias that are in the capital leave. So one of the men I spoke to said, you know, Tripoli's reached a boiling point. We've been patient for the past 2 years, and we've tried to talk to everyone, but nothing is happening. The government isn't doing anything.
You've reported that Tripoli is observing a 3-day general strike. Is that strike still going on, or is it back to business as usual in Tripoli?
It's not. I mean, today is the 3rd day of the general strike, and everything very much remains closed. All the shops are closed. The banks are closed. The only businesses that are open are bakeries and supermarkets and some pharmacies. Beyond that, everything's closed. Driving around the streets, it's clearly not a normal day here. Most of them are eerily empty, and you can see the blockades in various districts that were erected since Friday. The blockades remained in place pretty much until yesterday in various areas, and today only we've seen some of them being removed.
BBC's Rana Jawad talking to us from Libya. Rana, thank you as always for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You know what a selfie is, right? Look it up. It's the word of the year, according to the publishers of the Oxford Dictionary. But what we actually want to describe right now is the un-selfie. It's a way to help mobilize aid for the survivors of Typhoon Haiyan. It works like this. Write a simple donation call to action on a sheet of paper, something like supportunicef.org/Philippines, then add the hashtag unselfie. Take a picture of yourself holding the paper in front of your face and post it on social media. David Guerrero is the creative chairman of BBDO Guerrero, the ad agency in Manila that came up with the idea.
We went into the office on Monday morning wishing to do something to help in the recovery effort. And, you know, we all sat down and came up with a bunch of ideas and basically gave ourselves a couple of days to think of something that could help. Out of all the ideas we saw, this one just seemed the most shareable and the most doable. Just thought this was a simple way for people to substitute their normal activity of uploading the selfies and use the idea of unselfies to spread the word about how to donate.
What does the project do? What are you asking people to do?
We're asking people to change their behavior of uploading self-portraits, selfies of themselves, and instead to donate the space that their face normally takes up by substituting that with the web address of UNICEF or Red Cross or any organization they believe will best help the people of the Philippines to recover from the devastating typhoon that has taken place.
So what you can tell from social media is unselfie catching on?
Well, we're obviously thrilled by some of the response. And I think the statistics that we've seen, we've had about 9 million impressions. We've had response from the State Department. John Kerry has posted one. Mia Farrow has retweeted something. And we've just seen, you know, an amazing kind of response to this.
I know you said that the people should decide who to support, but are you guys pushing any one organization over another?
Well, we have seen the action on the ground of the big charities, the Red Cross, UNICEF, and Save the Children, and many others. So obviously, those are the charities that people feel comfortable to give to. So we think that's absolutely fine. But yeah, it's just a device for people to give prominence to something they believe in. And I think that will vary from person to person. But we suggested the big charities up front just to overcome any barriers people might have about them.
Just to get people going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you are based in Manila, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
So I wonder if anyone at your company, your ad agency, has been personally affected by Haiyan.
Yes, one of our art directors, his family came from the island, Leyte, that was directly hit by the typhoon. And he had a couple of very anxious days when he couldn't contact his family. And fortunately, he was able to reach them a couple of days ago. So he's, you know, been very relieved that they're okay.
And we will have some of those unselfie portraits on our website, PRI.org. David Guerrero is creative chairman of the ad agency BBDO, based in Manila, and the creator of the Unselfie campaign. David, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you so much, too.
This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. Toronto Mayor Rob Ford is now mayor in name only. The city council has stripped him of all substantive powers, but the crack-smoking, heavy-drinking, foul-mouthed Ford still refuses to step down. If you've been following this story, and who hasn't, right? Perhaps the thought has crossed your mind that the whole saga is worthy of an opera. Well, you're not alone.
I'm Mayor Rob Ford, your champion. Never smoked crack. Ahem, wait, I've smoked crack. I'm just in a drunken stupor. Sorry, my bad, I've done wrong. Just vote me in again, this too shall pass. I love my job, God bless.
That is from an actual aria about Mayor Rob Ford, commissioned by our friends at the CBC show Day 6. Brent Bambury is the host, and Brent, we'll get to that aria in just a moment. Nice tune, by the way. But first, we'll fill us in on where things stand with His Honor, the mayor.
Well, yesterday at a city council meeting, the mayor was stripped of most of his powers, including the power to over his budget, and that will probably result in him losing staff. But the meeting itself was, even by Toronto standards, disruptive, disrespectful, circus-like, quite strange. And there were a number of incidents that happened, including another council person being knocked to the ground as Mayor Ford charged around the room, supposedly because he thought his brother, who is also a councillor, was about to get into some kind of a fracas. And these are the flaws that make him so operatic, you know?
So, Brent, about that aria, it kind of seems a little bit like you're, singing to the converted. I mean, wouldn't his supporters just say you're the typical media elite bashing their down homie kind of guy?
I like the aria because there's nothing about it that's dishonest. It's true that Ford denied and then admitted, but still said that he wouldn't resign. That's how the aria it ends, with him saying, I will not resign. Opera is a great form for Ford because, you know, a bunch of police documents were dropped last week, almost 500 pages of them. And it was Ford under surveillance, but it's also interviews with some of Ford's previous staff. One staff member reported getting drunken phone calls from Ford in the middle of the night from his father's gravesite. You know, his father was a politician and a member of the provincial parliament here, and obviously extremely influential in Ford's life. So that call from the graveyard in the middle of the night, that would be probably the central aria in the third act of one of Verdi's operas. It's just the most operatic scene imaginable. So the form might not be in Ford's kind of milieu, but it's definitely fitting for the story that's unfolding in front of us.
You know, we in the media always hate to play on stereotypes, but in America, we always think of Canadians as so nice and tolerant. What is going on? I mean, we seem to be seeing this kind of red-blue divide that we get here in the U.S.
Yeah, people have compared some of this to, because Ford identifies as a conservative, and people have compared some of this to the Tea Party, but, you know, I don't see Ted Cruz running around miming drunk driving as Ford did yesterday in the council meeting. So it's a little step beyond that. We've gone from being Mr. Rogers to being Martin Scorsese, and I don't know why it's happened now, but that's where we are.
Mayor Ford, as you said, remains defiant. He says he'll hang in until elections next fall when voters can decide if he should stay or go. That is a long time with a mayor in name only. Where does the city go from here?
Well, I think that the city is basically under the trusteeship of council right now politically. But, you know, in 2010, when Ford was elected, we essentially elected a two-year-old. And after he's been in office for 3 years, he's not evolved into a five-year-old. So in a year's time, he'll have pulled off this amazing feat of still being 2 years old. So the people who voted for him back in 2010, they may return and vote for him again. I doubt it very, very much. And the other thing is that he hasn't really answered a lot of questions about some of the most egregious behavior that's been alleged. And during a campaign, he really will have to answer those questions.
Well, you know, perhaps it is exactly that everyman behavior that has made him so popular. You know, he talks sports, he drinks beer, he doesn't go to the opera, he's just a regular guy.
But he really isn't an everyman, and he also is an incredibly politically connected person who comes from a political family, very wealthy family. So he's not really the person that he pretends to be. In fact, it's unclear who that person is. I mean, you can look at the documents that came out that show him under police surveillance. You get a very different picture than I think the regular beer drinking, hockey attending Canadian everyman. And it's much darker and more sinister.
Brent Bambury is host of the CBC show Day 6, also distributed here in the U.S. by PRI. And you can hear the full Rob Ford aria commissioned by Day 6 at PRI.org.
Protects us taxpayers. Now it's time to move on.
We bring you now the tale of another opera lover. Okay, opera wasn't around in Leonardo da Vinci's time, but I imagine him as an opera lover. Anyway, the 15th century artist dreamed up many inventions, from flying machines to military devices. Oh, and don't forget his musical inventions, like the viola organista, that sort of a cross between a cello and a piano. Da Vinci included his design for the instrument nearly 500 years ago in his Codex Atlanticus. But apparently, like many of his designs, a full-size version was never built until now. It took Polish concert pianist Sławomir Zabrzucki 3 years to build his viola organista. From the outside, it looks like a baby grand piano. But inside, there are no hammered strings. Instead, 4 spinning wheels are wrapped in horsehair, like violin bows. To turn them, Zabrzucki pumps a pedal that's connected to a crankshaft. Zabrzucki unveiled Da Vinci's invention and played it at a concert in Krakow, Poland. And he says it's almost as if Da Vinci himself were talking to him through it.
Well, I don't know what Da Vinci may say about that, but that instrument is very expressive. And when I want to make something, my instrument makes something more. What I want and something else. It looks like he's talking to me.
Another concert pianist in the audience in Krakow, Gábor Farkas, liked what he heard. He told the British newspaper The Daily Mail, quote, "One thing the piano is missing is that as soon as you hit one note, it dies. Here you can make a crescendo. It's the dream of all pianists," end quote. You can see Leonardo da Vinci's Viola Organista in action. We have a video at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Marco Werman is back tomorrow, and we hope you will be too.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.